At the outset, nothing in this podcast should be interpreted as legal advice. Further, the views or opinions expressed in this podcast do not represent those of the university. Please email campbelllawreporter@email.campbell.edu for any media inquiries and third-party distributions. Welcome to the Campbell Law Reporter Podcast. This legal podcast strives to expand Campbell University's mission to lead with purpose by reporting with purpose. We hope to breathe new life into the dusty reporters on the shelves by reporting the content through captivating discussions. Our mission is to provide current and interesting reporting on legal topics affecting today's professionals. Listeners can expect to hear from various hosts throughout the year.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Campbell Law Reporter Podcast. I'm Brian Hedrick. Today we are talking about wrongful convictions, and we're joined by Stephen Duke, who is a professor emeritus of law from Yale Law School. Professor Duke specializes in criminal law and procedure, evidence, and drug policy. He obtained his JD from the University of Arizona, where he was also the editor-in-chief of the first Arizona Law Review. He also received an LLM from Yale Law School, clerked for the Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, and has argued three cases before the United States Supreme Court. Lastly, Professor Duke has been published in various law reviews on topics such as drug policy, mass imprisonment, bail reform, and eyewitness testimony in criminal convictions. Professor Duke, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So I asked this question of everybody who's come on so far this year because I think it's the best way to understand who you really are. And that's just starting with why. So what motivates you to research and write about criminal law?
Well, being convicted of a serious crime is one of the worst things that can happen to anyone. It's kind of analogous to a serious car wreck or the death of a close relative. It's something that should not be visited on people that don't deserve it. It's bad enough that we have to convict people that do deserve it. But the notion of somebody having nothing to do with the crime, having to be punished for it, and having such horrible consequences attached to it is something that should disturb anybody. It disturbs me especially because having spent my life learning about the criminal process, I have feel some sense of responsibility for its outcome. I feel like I should be doing something about its mistakes, of which there are many. So that's why I'm interested in it. I mean, I deplore serious automobile accidents, but I can't do much about that. I can't do much about convicting the innocent either, since I've never been a prosecutor, but at least I feel like I should do what I can, which is to write about it and talk about it and teach it.
You've taught about it for a long time, and I mentioned some of the articles. You definitely have devoted a lot of your time to this, so we appreciate that, and I appreciate you coming on here and talking about it as well. But to make sure everybody understands the base level of what we're talking about here, in the most basic form, what is a wrongful conviction? How do you define that?
A wrongful conviction is a conviction that is not based upon true facts, or that is not based upon the correct law. Either one is a wrongful conviction.
Okay, and I want to dive into that a little bit more. You said wrong facts or wrong law. Can you give, obviously there's confidentiality and things like that, so don't, you know, fall into that. But if you can kind of give us some general examples of what you mean by wrong facts or wrong law.
Well, a standard wrongful conviction would be where the wrong person, the wrong perpetrator, gets found guilty of a crime. That would also include cases in which no crime in fact occurred, but somebody was found to have committed a crime. The wrong law would be an example. Actually, this was one of the people that were exonerated recently. A person was convicted of failing to register as a sex violator when it was later determined that the law requiring registration had expired. So it was no longer the law.
Okay.
So he was convicted on the wrong law.
Okay, so you've kind of hit on it there a little bit of what some of the causes are. But just to kind of give you the opportunity to open it more, what would you say are the primary causes of wrongful convictions, whether those be factual or the law wrongful convictions?
Well, in a general sense, the causes of wrongful convictions are our adversary system. Our system relies upon all sorts of people that have shortcomings, both as in intelligence, in skill, in motivation, in honesty. And when those shortcomings end up in a wrongful conviction, that's the cause of the wrongful conviction. I think what you mean is something more specific. I can tell you what has caused the wrongful conviction of the people who have been exonerated. The National Registry of Exonerations has listed the primary causes of wrongful convictions of those who have been exonerated. And here they are: perjury or false accusations, 62%. That is, that was present in 62% of the cases in which there was an exoneration. Official misconduct, 59%. Mistaken eyewitnesses, 36%. False or misleading forensic evidence, 23%. And false confessions, 14%. Now, these five causes were intermixed. That is, they were two or three of them were present in a single case in many instances. Now, all that means is these are the causes or the contributors to false convictions in the cases in which there were exoneration. That doesn't really tell us the causes or the distribution of causes of wrongful convictions generally. For example, I have written a law review article in which I argue that false memories of conversations contribute to a lot of false conviction. That is, people quote defendants or other witnesses as having said X, Y, or Z, when in fact they didn't say X, Y, or Z. That's an erroneous memory of a conversation that can convict people. For example, suppose the alleged conversation was a confession. It is a witness testifies that he heard the defendant say, "I did it." Well, if he's wrong about that, then he may convict an innocent person. There is no way, our system does not protect much against erroneous memories of false conversations. Those, whatever mistakes are made based upon that, are mistakes that remain, for the most part, so we will never really know how many things cause and what distribution of erroneous convictions. But right. This is what we do know. And if we know what happens, what's present in cases in which erroneous convictions are rectified.
Things like false memory through, you know, technological innovations or DNA innovations, something like that is not going to be, you know, fixed. So I imagine that's probably stayed constant over the years. But you also mentioned 23% of these are from forensic evidence. So have things like, you know, DNA innovations or technological innovations, how has that impacted those who are being exonerated?
We discovered the relevance of DNA to false convictions in 1989 when a guy named Gary Dodson was wrongly convicted of rape, and we did a DNA analysis of what was alleged to be semen and blood on the alleged victim's underwear. And there was testimony at trial that suggested that the blood type of this matched that of Gary Dodson. But when a DNA analysis was done, it was found to match that of the alleged victim, not Gary Dodson. And it turned out the alleged victim made up the story. And so Dodson was exonerated. And since then, we have used DNA to exonerate something like 300 people. DNA is also very useful in finding the guilty people and convicting the guilty people. And the more evidence you can get to convict the guilty, the more that evidence is available to help protect the innocent. So DNA has been very useful in protecting the innocent, not only in exonerating people wrongly convicted, but in people suspected of being guilty of a crime. However, DNA is only useful in cases in which bodily fluids of the perpetrator are available for examination. And we don't know what percentage of serious criminal cases involve bodily fluids of the perpetrator, but my guess is it's not more than 10%. So DNA just isn't helpful in the run-of-the-mill criminal prosecution.
Okay. Have there been any other types of innovations, whether that be technological or just more research being done on the legal side of these things, that has decreased the amount of people who are being wrongfully convicted, or has, I guess another way of saying it, increased the number of people who are being exonerated?
Well, I don't know of any scientific discovery comparable to DNA. Certainly, forensic techniques have improved. Analysis of fingerprints, for example, has improved. Voice prints analysis has improved. Face prints have improved. So there have been a lot of forensic advances that should protect against convicting some innocent people.
So out of those who are being exonerated, what's kind of the demographic breakdown? So what does that look like as far as race or poverty, things like in those categories?
Among the DNA exonerations, 53% are Black. I don't have the breakdown of anything else other than the Black, but probably whites are about 40% of the, and whereas Blacks are 13.6% of the population. So it's certainly skewed. The Black population certainly is a disproportionate representative of the wrongly convicted. No doubt about that.
Okay. And we've talked a lot about this, you know, term exoneration, and we've kind of rephrased some of the questions to talk about exoneration. I just want to take a step back here and talk about what's the process of actually becoming exonerated.
There is no specific process. I can tell you some of the institutions that have been responsible for exonerations in the last 30 years. One is called a Conviction Integrity Unit. These are formed by prosecuting attorneys. There are quite a few of those. There are 97 of them, to be specific, in this country. And they have been involved in about 700 exonerations. That is, the DA's office itself conducts investigations to make sure that they have not convicted an innocent person. And in about 700 cases, they have concluded that they did. That's over a period of about 30 years. And of course, DNA analysis is the primary responsible for exonerations. I think they've probably there have been about 2,500 exonerations since 1989, and DNA has been responsible for, actually DNA is responsible for only 375 of those exonerations. So most exonerations are produced by people like myself, who just took on a case and pressed it far enough that they produced evidence of innocence. Those are non-institutional cases. Lawyers who believe in the innocence of their clients.
So I want to dig into that just a little bit more. And obviously, you know, you don't need to get into any specifics, but just whatever you're allowed and able to tell us, you can. What does that kind of look like when you have a client who you know is innocent and you're now pursuing this exoneration path? What does that kind of look like? What steps do you have to take when that happens?
I worked for 3.5 years on a case where the client had already been convicted of being part of a big drug smuggling operation. And it was basically an eyewitness case. A courier had delivered a load of heroin to somebody that he ultimately identified from photographs and show-ups, my client, and succeeded in getting him convicted at trial. And I came in after that conviction and took an appeal, which was unsuccessful, and engaged in various acts of litigation. Ultimately, I got the conviction reversed because the prosecutor had hypnotized the eyewitness and had not disclosed that to the defense. Court reversed the conviction. And in the meantime, I conducted an investigation of the fact we knew who the guilty person was. There's no question that we knew it, and we even confronted him and recorded the confrontation in which he basically admitted that he was the guilty person. But we couldn't persuade the judge, because the judge had just decided that my client was guilty and nothing would have changed his mind. So fortunately, we got the conviction reversed, got it retried, and he was acquitted by the jury. And there aren't any real specific ways of getting a convicted person exonerated, but if you can't find physical evidence, forensic evidence, or find a guilty person to step forward and say, I did it, not your God, it's very, very difficult in this country to get a conviction set aside. Extremely difficult.
Okay. Do you think it's...
And that's one place where we could have some reform. It could become easier to attack convictions on the basis of innocence.
How can, if there are any, practical ways, how can this system be improved or modified in any way to either lower the risk of wrongful convictions or to kind of, set, because in my mind, it would be easier if there's kind of a set path for exoneration. What ways can it be improved either before conviction or after the conviction?
That list could go on for, listing that could go on for hours.
Okay.
We could change the rules of evidence a little bit to make it not so easy to introduce prejudicial evidence against a defendant. Could make it easier for a defendant to offer evidence suggesting that someone else might have committed the crime. We could improve the quality of defense counsel, and we could make more resources available to the defense. Most defendants are broke or close to it. Most public defenders are overworked, and they also tend to presume that their clients are guilty, because most of them are. So they kind of have a presumption of guilt that can affect the motivation of some of them. I don't know what could be done about that. Making more resources available to the defense would certainly be a big factor.
Okay.
We could also be more demanding of defense counsel in terms of competence. Very little is demanded of defense counsel to meet the standard that the Supreme Court has set for the Sixth Amendment. In other words, if your lawyer is bad enough, it could be a violation of the Sixth Amendment, but they have to be really bad. And also, a lot of courts would say, we don't care how bad the lawyer was. It wouldn't have made any difference anyway. Looking at the evidence, the defendant would have been convicted if he had Perry Mason. That's what the courts say in cases like that. I think they should be a little more imaginative in evaluating what counsel might have been able to do.
Okay, so I'm going to back up and talk about a couple of these that you hit on. So the most interesting thing you said out of that was that there are some cases where an attorney does something so bad. What's kind of an example of where the court actually found an attorney did something so bad in their defense of the client?
I think there was one case where the attorney slept through a good chunk of the trial. There's another case where the attorney slept through the trial, good chunk of the trial. The court said it didn't make any difference. But there was another case where they said, that's just unacceptable.
Okay, wow. So yeah, it does really have to be extreme.
Well, basically, courts presume defendants are guilty. That biases their judgments in many cases. And there aren't that many judges that really presume innocence and act accordingly. Not many judges, after they've been sitting in court for a while, they get jaundiced by what they see. They hear ridiculous defenses and ridiculous claims and perjurious witnesses. And they get just kind of inured to that. And they need to fight against it.
Okay, definitely, definitely. I understand that. The last question I'll ask you here is, when somebody goes through this whole process, they go through the trial, they get convicted, then exonerated, and they're back out, I assume this varies between states, but are there any programs that kind of, you know, compensate that person for the time they spent or tries to make up for anything or get them back to be a productive person again? Are there any programs to set them up for success down the road?
Well, some states have statutory provisions dealing with exonerating the wrongly convicted. Some of them are, unfortunately, have caps on them so that the defendant can't recover a great deal of money. Others, like Connecticut, just pass a piece of legislation for someone that's been exonerated, and they determine each case on its own for determining what amount of money should be allotted to the defendant. There was a case in Boston in which I had an indirect involvement, in which the FBI and the state police were involved in fabricating a case against many of the defendants. And they spent about 28 years in prison. And a federal judge awarded each of the defendants $1 million a year for every year they spent in prison. And the appellate court upheld it.
So we've talked about a lot. I always leave whoever I interview with the last word, so I'll definitely say thank you for coming on. But I'll leave the floor open to you. Is there anything that you want to let us know about, whether it's wrongful convictions or just criminal law in general, just what your kind of your parting thought on this topic is?
I think it is an immensely challenging subject matter, immensely important. I urge students, if they can, to have something to do with protecting the innocent, because who knows, it could be your friend or family or somebody of great importance to you that gets caught up in this system.
Yes, that's a great place to end it. Professor Stephen Duke, thank you for your time. Thank you for talking about this and for all you've done in the field of criminal law. That concludes this episode of the Campbell Law Reporter Podcast.
Thank you.
This is the Campbell Law Reporter.
Thank you for listening to the Campbell Law Reporter Podcast. We look forward to you joining us every other Wednesday at 7 a.m. for a new episode, which can be accessed through your preferred podcasting listening platform.
This is the Campbell Law Reporter.